You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore. On September the 23rd, the state of Georgia is scheduling the execution of Troy Davis, a black man, for the murder of Mark MacPhail, a white police officer. The Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles has denied clemency for Troy Davis, an innocent man on Georgia's death row. Troy now faces an execution date of September 23rd, even though the U.S. Supreme Court isn't set to hear an appeal in his case until September 29th. Troy Davis has been wrongfully convicted of killing Mark MacPhail, the police officer. No physical evidence ties Davis to the crime, and 7 of the 9 eyewitnesses have recanted their testimony, many saying they identified Davis because of intense police pressure. One of them, Monty Holmes, said, "I was scared. They wouldn't stop questioning me until I told them that what they wanted to hear. So I did." Today we'll talk with Daryl Myers, a board member of Campaign to End the Death Penalty and a member of Murder Victims' Families for Human Rights. Daryl is also a longtime activist for civil rights and against war. Welcome, Daryl. It's great to have you with us.
It's good to be here, and I thank you so much for having me on your program.
Well, Daryl, you're going to speak about Troy Davis, but you also have your own story to tell, and I'm going to invite you to tell our listeners how you came to this work.
Well, as you mentioned in the intro, my entire adult life, going on close to 50 years now, the capital punishment was never, until recently, a big, very high up on my agenda, in part because here in California, there just were not many executions, and there wasn't a lot of publicity around it, and there were many other important issues. But in 1996, my 23-year-old son was murdered here in San Francisco just in an act of random violence. There was no apparent reason for this young man to kill him, other than the fact that he was there at the wrong place at the wrong time. And it occurred to me as a result of that getting to know, in the process of dealing with this great tragedy, getting to know my son Jojo's friends, who were mostly young people of color, working class people of color, who were having to deal with this issue of increasing violence in their communities, poverty, unemployment, violence, decreasing opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. And I realized that many of them were thrown for a loss as to why this violence was happening, and felt an obligation to try to help understand it more deeply myself, and hopefully to help them understand what is going wrong and what to do about it, because it's very popular to believe that the way you deal with violence is you punish the perpetrators, find the guilty, punish the perpetrators, and then we move on to the next scene in our lives.
And everything then is safe and secure, and we can, as you say, move on.
Exactly. And I felt that we have to get to the roots of these problems. And 2 weeks after, on Valentine's Day, Jojo's mother and I, Naomi White, wrote an op-ed piece for the Bay Guardian, in which I said basically that, yes, we want to know who the person was and get him off the street so that he can't kill or hurt again, that we have an obligation to, you know, to protect ourselves, to protect society. On the other hand, there is, he's not the only one responsible for this problem, for this kind of violence, that there are policymakers in our country who are creating high rates of unemployment, low rates of opportunity, for no other reason than greed, and I don't know if it's exactly racism, but it comes out as racism because it's a discrimination against the poor, a criminalization of poverty itself, and that drives people to very extreme behavior. And we think that the young man who killed our son, even though we can't identify him, was as much a product of this society as the gun which he used to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of that op-ed piece, I was asked to speak at San Quentin Prison the night they were to execute William Bonin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a difficult choice on my part, or decision on my part, because William Bonin was, without a doubt, one of the worst of the worst. He had been arrested 10 years, much earlier, for raping teenage boys in Southern California. They called him the freeway murderer.
So he would rape and then murder these young men?
No, at first he would only rape them. But because they got one of the young men to identify him,
uh-huh.
he spent a number of years in prison. As a result of that, when he got out of prison, he continued to rape young men, boys, but he killed them so that they couldn't identify
mm-hmm.
him.
Which is not an unusual trajectory. We hear about this.
Yes, right.
Right.
To protect themselves.
Right.
I don't mean to sound like it's justified or reasonable, but... it is a trajectory that is a result of this incarceration frenzy and this punishment approach to, you know, to reducing violence in our society. Some friends of mine said, you know, why are you speaking out to save the life of this, you know, this monster? And I said, because we have to make an attempt to, as a society, to bring these people back into the human race. That it does not solve the problem to kill them and then to act like because... we found William Bonin, we've convicted him, now we will execute him. The rest of us are innocent, and he takes the full blame for what goes on. It turns out that he was a Vietnam veteran, that he had psychological problems, that he had been an abused, physically abused, and sexually abused child. And this was not brought out in public until after his execution. And I thought, you know, that's where we have to begin. We have to look at the roots of this violence. What drives people to this kind of sadism, this kind of madness? And so I did speak out at San Quentin, at the vigil, to oppose his execution. It was difficult, but I felt an obligation to do that. At the vigil, there were also people there who supported the execution and were interrupting and shouting and disrupting the vigil, and I went over and I talked to them, and I told them I understood, because some of them were relatives of some of the victims
mm-hmm.
of this man, and,
mm-hmm.
and I said, I really understand how you feel. I lost my son two or three weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
and I know exactly how you feel, your outrage and all, but I said, after you kill William Bonin, what will you do tomorrow morning to make the world safer and to produce less William Bonins? What can we do? Is there anything we can do? And they said, well, no, you know, we just have to keep killing them.
Mm.
And I said, well, they said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm going to continue to work to make this country, you know, a better place where there's more opportunity, where there's less violence, where we feel have the right to intervene in family matters when children are being abused, and try to help, you know, create the kind of environment that at least reduces, if not eliminates, this kind of random individual street violence.
Mm-hmm.
Our obligation to do that.
Yeah. Daryl, let me ask you this. This is one of the countries that has the highest degree of what we call individualism. And the tendency is to believe that each person is totally responsible for his or her own life, that you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. But what I'm hearing you saying is that there's a grander picture here, which is that we also belong to a community and we're responsible for members of the community and how the community is educated.
Yeah, I think so. I think community is an important grounding for all of us. This individual responsibility, this individual success and individual failure, like pull yourself up by the bootstraps kind of attitude. But if people don't have boots, they don't have bootstraps, how do they pull themselves up?
Mm-hmm.
We have a 40% unemployment rate, you know, among African American males, youth, between the ages of 18 and 30, I think it is. I would like to know how the legislatures, how the congressmen, how the wealthy would deal with 40% unemployment if 40% of the Congress had no income. We reduce the purchasing power of unemployment insurance, and many of these people never get jobs, so they're not even qualified for unemployment insurance. We're experiencing a 42% dropout rate among black males in the Oakland schools. And it's not because of their race that the failures are so great or that the crisis is so deep. It's poverty that's causing this. But if people can say, well, you know, they're just not educated people, they're just not this, they're not up to this and that, then that becomes racism, of course. But it's based on a classist idea that if you're poor in America, it's because you're lazy or because you're stupid or a combination of both. Mm-hmm. So that the people who are suffering most in this country are made out to be their fault that they're on the bottom of the social pyramid. We've got to reverse that. We've got to think of ourselves not as a heartless business, but as a nation of people, like a family. We have to take care of each other. If we see problems, we have to deal with those problems. Look at the bailouts that they're doing now. $700 billion Bush is asking for, and I'm sure both of the presidential candidates are going to support a similar policy. That is, these people who went wild and broke the, I don't know if they broke the law, but they broke just all the morality of business and all that, and they cheated, they stole, they took risk, they deregulated the economy to the point where it's a serious disaster now, and they're going to get a bailout. We don't have enough money to keep people in school. You know, if you have 40 kids in a classroom, my son Jojo, when he was in high school, he said in his math class, kids were sitting on the stairs in the auditorium, in the steps in the mm-hmm. auditorium. There weren't enough seats in the classroom. They sat on the stairs, you know, for this class. But we can find $700 billion, probably $1 trillion, to rescue people who already have more money than they need. But the people who don't have enough money are being neglected and being vilified and being blamed. And if they develop antisocial attitudes, why should we be surprised? Mm-hmm. I mean, if society treats them like scum, like undeserving members of our society, then how do we expect these young people to grow up and respect a society?
Well, not to mention, as you pointed out, the United States also has one of the highest incarceration rates in the world. Yeah. We're on a par with China, Saudi Arabia, Korea with executions. So clearly this is not working. We have to come up with a better way of dealing with this, and yet that seems to just fly in the face of the current mentality.
Yes. In the last 30 years, the policymakers of this country and this world have been wanting to roll back the regulations that they say keep them from making the kind of profits that could be shared then and make them a happy society. And they've succeeded in deregulating rules that govern how they behave, like banks couldn't invest in the stock market. And there were good reasons for that, because banks, when they use the money for speculation, then the money becomes very tenuous, and it becomes dangerous for a lot of people, especially when so many pension funds, retirement funds, etc., are invested in the stock market, and then the stock market is unregulated. We're looking at trillions of dollars that's being transferred upwards in this country. I mean, some of the estimates are $3 trillion just from the real estate crisis alone. That $3 trillion has been transferred from middle-class people to the profiteers, you know, running the economy. And that's the kind of thing that creates an immorality, this high degree of individualism, as you point out. The other side of the individualism is a social immorality, I think, that we didn't evolve to become individual survivors. We evolved to the point we did, whether, it's our literature, our art, the cathedrals of Europe, the industry. We evolved not because of individualism, but because of cooperation, because of social intercourse, because we lived as communities. That's how we learned language, how we learned agriculture, how we learned animal husbandry, by being a community or being communities. We're being taught the opposite, that the world functions best by by the greatness of mostly European men, and that the rest of us just have to look to find, you know, the kind of leaders that are going to treat us the best. And that's why I got involved in this work, because I believe that it's time we stopped looking upwards to find solutions to our problems and looking horizontally, if I can make kind of a simple analogy, to look to each other. Stop ignoring each other. We have to find ways to work together. We have to rebuild a democratic ethic. We have to rebuild a sense of community. We have to take care of all the children. As Bernadette Devlin said when she spoke at Mission High School 10 years ago, we've got to get back to the fundamentals of human society, of the ethics, the democratic ethic, the ethic of us taking care of each other, of living as communities. That's a very generalized statement. But I believe that in the process of working together, and there are many, many communities, they're different. There's not one kind of community that's going to solve the problems. There are thousands of different kinds of communities that exist in this world, from very small groups of people like Hilltop High School, helping these young mothers, many of them unwed mothers, all of them poor, to work together as a community, so they feel that they have help. They have, there are other people in this world that care about them.
I also want to point out the difference between individualist and individuation. I think we do want individuated human beings on this planet, which means that have self-agency. Individualism tends more to believing that you're the most important person in the world, and that sense of community turns into a sense of competition, that the other person is your competitor. Yes. But an individuated person is someone who is able to, you know, look at both sides of the picture, for example, and deal with complexity.
I really agree with that. We don't have to sacrifice ourselves in order to be a social human being.
That's not at all.
That's a false contradiction. It's a false dichotomy. I don't believe that. I believe we function at best when we have a solid base, you know, a family, a community, a village, a world in which we feel part of and where we can share ideas.
Now, environment also is part of what we respect as life-giving rather than something to plunder.
Yes, and not rather than something to control, something to enhance, something to work with. So in this work that I've been doing, there are great rewards that have come out of it. I've gotten to know many of JoJo's young friends who are in the hip-hop community, many of who are teachers now, many of whom have their own children and all that. It's like I've in the first weeks, months after his death, I felt huge emptiness in my life, almost like you could feel a physical feeling that there is this huge void, and that our family was destroyed. Both of his grandmothers had serious traumatic problems after that. He was one child. There was only one other cousin, a young man who also suffered greatly because of the violent loss of his cousin, who was a few years older and who he just adored. We felt like our family was just absolutely destroyed. But in the process, we rebuilt that family, and we gained other families. Families, because we work together to make things work, to solve problems together, not as individuals, but as a group. And it led me to the campaign to end the death penalty and murder victims' families for human rights, because I realized that I don't know if it's fair to other people who are suffering this kind of loss, but I'll say it anyway at the risk of sounding insensitive. I think closure is not something that I want or need. If closure means that then we close the chapter, you know, we close the book and we move on, I don't ever want to forget my son. I never want to stop thinking about him. I would rather have the tears than to finally bury him and move on and leave him behind. I don't mean that I want to, you know, keep him embalmed or in a mausoleum or, you know, that kind of continuation, but to continue the ideas that meant a lot to him, the work that he did. He worked with at-risk youth at Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School. He worked with kids, and his fellow teachers wrote a letter to the principal of the school the day before he was killed, asking if he could be put on permanently because he was such an effective worker with these young kids that were having difficulty sitting still in the classroom because they were hungry, or being able to pay attention, you know, to give the kind of focus that's needed in education, because they had so many problems on their minds, you know, with families, with evictions, with poverty and all that. Jojo understood that because he was assigned to special ed classes, because he was diagnosed as learning disabled, that he had mild dyslexia. And in those classrooms, he began to learn who these kids are, and they're so judged and disrespected. He felt he wanted to help them and change it, and that's why he got involved in the hip-hop community and why he went into this area of work. And that's the kind of thing that I want to keep alive, that goodness, that love, wanting. So I feel like, in a way, I want to be like him when I grow up. And I want to, you know, do the things that he would have done. So when we lose someone like that, I think, then we all have to pull together and fill in the void and keep him alive in that sense, keep his goodness alive and the things that he was contributing. So that's how I got involved in a way, in this work. And it's very rewarding because I now know people who, exonerees, perhaps a dozen exonerees of the 130 people who've been from death row, who've been exonerated. I've met their families, people like Gloria Johnson and whose son Montel Johnson is dying in prison in Illinois now. People like Martina Correa, whose brother, who's struggling with breast cancer and fighting to save the life of her brother. I'm meeting heroes, heroic people, people who are increasing my respect for people like myself, for common people, in this work. I'm being greatly rewarded by seeing a capacity in human beings that I wanted to believe is there. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing it there in this work, seeing people on death row who are very magnanimous human beings, very generous human beings, people who become jailhouse lawyers to help younger convicts defend themselves when they can't afford competent lawyers, and young people who don't have to but who are going, making friends with condemned men over in San Quentin, and they go visit them, you know, and befriend them and reach through the bars, over the walls, through the security glass. And that's very rewarding, because there was one point shortly, you know, after Jojo died, that I really didn't want to be alive in this world that's so cold. I didn't want to be here. I'd wake up, you know, in the middle of the night and think, oh God, I wish I didn't have to wake up to this world tomorrow. And I don't feel that way now. I feel that we have a chance. I feel in this work that I'm doing against the death penalty, and it's not just against the death penalty, it's against these lifetime incarcerations, these life sentences, life without parole, three strikes, 25 to life, these people who are going to die unfree. They're going to die in prison. Those two are death sentences, in my opinion. It's just a slower way of killing these people. And there's 145,000 people in this country who most of whom are going to die in prison. You know, the parole rate among those people with life sentences is about 1%. Mm-hmm. Only one out of four of those people ever even get before a parole board. There's thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, 2.5 million people who are incarcerated. Many of them, you know, for nonviolent crimes, many of them just because they needed to self-medicate to get through another day, or being punished because of that, because they can't afford prescription drugs or they don't like prescription drugs.
We have done a number of shows on the U.S. justice system, on Raising Sand, most recently one with Tony Papa. A very extraordinary story. He happened to just stumble upon art and became a very sensitive artist. And I urge people to go and listen to that show. He got 15 years for a minor drug offense.
Yes.
And his art got him out after 12. But you're right, he talks also about how demeaning the prison life is.
Yes. He's an example of people in the course of his work who I have the great benefit of getting to know, because it revived, it restored my belief. I wouldn't say a faith, but my belief in the capacity of humanity that we can live on this planet in a sustainable, a democratic, and a humanist way.
Yeah.
Where all children, you know, can have opportunities available to them, where all children are deserving of our love and our respect and the right to grow up to their full potential, their full capacity. Getting back to what you said about, the question of the individual, that by basing themselves in a healthy society, a healthy matrix of love and consideration and opportunity and magnanimity, we can all become greater than what we are, every single one of us. And I think we have the capacity to do that. We have the resources and the intelligence and the social skills, or we have the capacity for those skills, that we can do it. And that's why capital punishment is like on the opposite extreme of that. It's like war, you know, that war, violence, and punishment is the way to get humanity to function together smoothly, you know, that
yeah.
law and order that we need.
I want to remind our listeners that we're talking with Daryl Myers, who is working on the case for Troy Davis, and we're going to hear more about Troy. Daryl Myers is also a board member of Campaign to End the Death Penalty and a member of Murder Victims' Families for Human Rights. Troy is a young man. He's in Georgia. He's in jail. He's supposed to be executed on the 23rd of September, but the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, isn't set to hear an appeal in his case until September 29th. How did that happen?
I'm not a lawyer, and I don't fully understand all the differences. But essentially, you know, the changes in the laws since... If I could step back a little bit, in 1972, there were two cases before the Supreme Court that said that the application of the death penalty is arbitrary, and therefore it could be classified as unconstitutional. That and it's arbitrary in the sense that there are people who, of course, without means don't have access to legal defense, and they are subject then to a higher rate of incarceration and a higher rate of execution. And therefore, the death penalty, capital punishment in this country, is not applied in an equitable kind of way. The Supreme Court said that essentially that the states have to provide legal counsel and appellate support for condemned people who don't have the means to defend themselves. So for 4 years, the states rewrote or wrote new provisions that offered defense for capital cases. And essentially, all the states offered, those that have capital punishment, put together programs to, quote-unquote, supposedly guarantee or minimize the potential to execute innocent people. In California, we have, and in many states, we have an automatic appeal. Once you're condemned and once you get sentenced, it's just automatic that your case is appealed to the next level, the state Supreme Courts. And then the states are obligated to provide legal help for these cases all the way up to the Supreme Court. That was the concept, so that there wouldn't be innocent people sent to the gas chamber at that time or to get lethal injections to be executed. That's fallen apart. The Office I'm trying to remember the name, exactly what it's called. It's the Public Defender's Office of New Jersey. Commenting to the commission that recommended that New Jersey end its death penalty, commented that because they proposed that they replace capital punishment with life without parole. And the public defender's office said this is not a good solution because even with the very, very few people we have on death row in New Jersey, we are not funded enough to really provide the kind of defense that these people need. And if the juries then are given the option of life without parole, they're going to be much more willing to do that because they're not risking a life to offer this sentence. But the Public Defender's Office of New Jersey said there's a serious flaw here and that there's no provision for these people who get life without parole to get legal assistance from the states. We have approximately 3,500 people who are on death row in this country today. We have 10 times that number of people who are sentenced to life without parole. If there's not enough funds to really provide the kind of defense for these 3,500 people who are on death row, and by the way, there are people who complain that they don't like the long delays and the appeal after appeal after appeal. The reason that the delays are so long in great part is because the states are not offering enough lawyers to provide defense for everyone who's condemned. In California, for example, we have 650 people on death row, and less than a third of those people, I understand, have even gotten any legal help in their case. That is 450 other people have not even got lawyers assigned to them to help them appeal their cases, to prove their innocence or to gain clemency.
And then, not to impugn these public defenders, yes, but it's also true that in some cases they don't even deal with their client at all. I'm thinking specifically of a mother in Texas who was executed last year. Her name was Frances. I don't remember her last name. She was accused of killing her husband and two children, shooting them to death in the house.
Yeah.
And there was no evidence that she had done it, but her lawyer, her public defender, barely even looked at her case, and she was executed.
Yeah. And that's a serious problem, that we're not even providing the kind of legal defense. When these lawyers are assigned to it, they're not always public defenders. In California, we have a group that works in Sacramento that provides the appellate processes for these cases. But as I'm saying, there are 400 people who haven't got that. There are about 145,000 people in this country who have life sentences, and they have no access to legal representation because of poverty. And then that's part of why we have such a high number of people of color who are on death row, who are facing life sentences, because they don't have the funds. So even if there isn't blatant racism at play, which there is in cases, but I can't say that everybody, on the other side, that is the prosecutorial community, I can't say that they're all motivated by racism, but if poverty is a factor, then you have a high number of people of color, so it in effect is institutionalized racism that plays out so that you have high numbers of people. Of those 145,000 people with life sentences, 44,000 of them were guilty of nonviolent crimes. So we're proposing to throw people in prison for life who aren't even a literal threat, a violent threat to society.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the madness of it. Now, getting back to Troy, see, in his case, he didn't have a good defense. Here's the other problem, that the policies of the courts are that they're not looking at questions of innocence. That was part of what was introduced with the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, to speed up the process of the appeals for capital cases. An example is the example of Tommy Thompson. The California Supreme Court heard his case, and the court said, we have every reason to believe he is innocent. But we, the Supreme Court of California, are not authorized to second-guess the judges or the juries. Our role is only to oversee that the procedures of the trial were correct. Mm-hmm. And as far as we can tell, the procedures were correct. Although he's an innocent man, we cannot do anything about his sentence. And Tommy Thompson was executed. An innocent man was executed. The Supreme Court of California acknowledged his innocence but said we can't do anything about it. That's what's happening to our court system in this country, at least at the appellate level, that they're saying we are not going to retry these people. We're not going to have a rehearing of their guilt or their innocence. That's the case with Mumi Abu-Jamal. That's the case with Troy Davis. They will not hear the fact that 7 of the 9 people who testified and identified Troy Davis as the killer have recanted their statements, their accusations, and still they won't say, well, let's have a new trial. Even if they don't say, well, let's let it free him because he was convicted unjustly, they're saying we don't even have the authority to retry him. So that's the problem facing many people. Now, since 1976, when the states put forward these policies, these programs, to guarantee that no innocent people were going to be executed, we have already 130 exonerations of people from death row. And just in that amount of time, and that's about 1%, 2% of condemned population, that's a high number of innocent people who are facing death. And a lot of the people on death row can't even get the funds or the means by which they can get tested. Many of the cases are not dependent on DNA testing, but those that are, many people are still waiting years and years and years to get DNA testing because there aren't the funds to do it, and the states, you know, in some cases the prosecutors find roadblocks to that. So we have many cases of innocent people. We have to assume that there's a high number of innocent people, and since 1976, because this is since when the state supposedly put in these laws to guarantee that innocent people are not going to go to death row, that they're not going to be executed. And already we have 130 with all these guarantees. So that's what Troy Davis is facing. And so we have to think not just in terms of defending Troy Davis and trying to save his life, but we have to reform and revise the whole criminal justice system that is moving more and more away from the ability of people without means to find ways to defend themselves. Because if you don't have money, you don't have justice. You can't have justice in this country. Troy Davis did not have highly respected or powerful lawyers to defend him. I mean, think about that. That the courts of the appellate courts of the United States are saying, we are not going to review question of guilt or innocence. That does not matter to us. All we care about is reviewing whether the procedures were correct in this person's case. And if they were correct, we don't care. I mean, maybe they don't say we don't care. They're saying we do not have to deal with the innocence of Troy Davis. He is going to die if it's determined that the procedures in his case were correct. And they don't accept the word of these witnesses who say, I was 15 years old, and the police told me that if I don't help them identify the killer, I'm going to spend the rest of my life in prison. Now, what would you do?
Exactly.
And the courts are saying also, some of the more conservative courts, legal folks, are saying, well, how can you trust if these people lied once, maybe they're lying now? That's what they said in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, where 3 out of the 5 witnesses have recanted their testimony. So we have cases where people who jailhouse snitches and people who prostitutes, and I don't mean to disparage women who are forced into that position in life, the point is that they were subject to police harassment and police power, and they were threatened, like in Mumia's case, that, you know, you've been arrested 3 times for prostitution, and if you don't do what we want, you're going to spend the next 40 years of your life in prison, and you'll never see your children again. That's how they're getting a lot of these convictions. So Troy Davis is not just a victim of circumstance. He's a victim of a criminal justice system that incredibly discriminates against people without means, that is, people who are poor, whether they're black or white. And the consequences is the greater, you know, a much higher percentage of African Americans, Hispanics, Native Americans are in prison proportionally than white people, and if for no other reason than poverty. And then you have to add to that, in some cases, like we saw in the case of the Gina 6, out and out blatant racism against these young high school students that were defending themselves down there in Gina, Louisiana.
We have some numbers here for our listeners to call to the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles. So there's two things that are occurring to me. We're going to go ahead and give these numbers, but I'm also wondering, there's a greater picture here that you're painting. So people can both call this number, whether it works or not, at least these people in Georgia, the Board of Pardons, will know them are people that are concerned about the state of our legal system. But also that we need to continue working on the larger picture. Yeah, so let me do this. Let me give out that number. So call the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles on behalf of Troy Davis, 404-651-6671. And the person that you will be talking to there is Gail Buckner at 404-657-9350. 404-651-6671. And the other is the board chair, Gail Buckner, 404-657-9350. And on the larger picture, we know that Amnesty International, Amnesty USA, is doing a lot of work on this system. How else can people plug into this and make, I mean, basically it's us, the taxpayer, we're paying for these people to be killed.
Well, at least for those in California and in the Bay Area, on the weekend of September 26, 27, 28, Critical Resistance is having a 10th anniversary conference that will discuss. There will be many workshops, many presentations, plenary sessions where these issues will be discussed. The whole concept of the criminal justice system. Ray Davis's sister, Martina Correa, is going to be speaking at a workshop organized by the Campaign to End the Death Penalty, which is called Live from Death Row. We do something that's very powerful. We do a phone call in which the audience can actually ask questions, where the death row inmate talks to the audience, and then in most cases we have questions and answers. I think it will be either Kenneth Foster Jr., who was commuted from death row to life imprisonment in Texas, or Kevin Cooper, who's at San Quentin here in California. Barbara Becknell, who was a good friend of Tookie Williams and who helped publish his works, is going to present, and she's going to present a film about Tookie Williams and the horror of lethal injections, that it's not as clean and clinical as people think. It's, mm-hmm. I think, a fairly pretty gut-wrenching film. But the conference itself, one can go to Critical Resistance and or CR10, and get the full schedule. I highly recommend it. There are going to be activists from all over the country who are trying to reform or completely abolish the criminal justice system. There are many approaches, many different issues affecting the families of prisoners, life without parole, three strikes here in California. There will be people speaking, family members who have loved ones who are spending years and years, decades in prison because of three strikes laws, mm-hmm. Including Santos Reyes, who has already spent 9 years in prison and is facing 25 to life, who had two nonviolent felonies and who was convicted of a felony because he took a driver's license test for his cousin, who didn't speak or read English, but who needed a license to be able to work in the roofing industry with him. Mm. The prosecutor escalated that infraction from a misdemeanor to a felony because he said it was a conspiracy. And Santos Reyes, because he took a test for his cousin, is already spent 9 years in prison. Those are many of the issues that will be taken up by that. Mm-hmm. Okay. And though for those people who hear this who are in the Midwest, the Campaign to End the Death Penalty is having its national convention in Chicago in the week of November 6th through the weekend of November 6th through 8th, where we will discuss many of these cases. Troy Davis's sister will be there, Martina. Many family members, many exonerees will be there. Those are two ways that people can get involved.
As you mentioned Tookie Williams, I wanted to open up that conversation we'd started in the beginning of this program, which was the lack of assurance to people that the system, even though you rehabilitate yourself,
right,
that the system will continue to respect you. In fact, Tukey Williams had rehabilitated in an amazing fashion. He was actually a symbol to a lot of young people about gangs. And yet the message that came loud and it came across loud and clear was that this doesn't really matter. We're going to execute him anyway.
Well, that raises the whole question, too, that it's not just the innocent that we need to protect and defend and help, but those who might have been guilty of crimes. An excellent book on this whole subject is by Dr. James Gilligan, who worked 25 years with the most violent men in prison in Massachusetts. At one point, he says that he believes everybody on this planet is redeemable. You know, some may take longer than others, some, you know, a lifetime. I agree with him that we have to function on that basis, that the solution is not punishment. We indeed need to separate some people from society to protect society. But that doesn't mean that by punishing them, we're going to make them better human beings. In fact, the contrary, Dr. Gilligan claims that the contrary is true, that in his experience, without a doubt, the most punished men in prison in Massachusetts were the most punished children.
Mm.
Now think about that. Mm. That he says, without exception, the most violent people, the most sadistic, violent people, were the ones who are the most punished as children. I read recently that there were 650,000 reported cases of corporal punishment of children in the school systems of this country.
Hmm.
650,000 reported cases. Now, think about this, too. 90% of those cases of corporal punishment with whips and with boards, humiliation, degradation in front of other children in the class, took place in the former southern states of this country.
Mm.
Greatest amount of punishment, the philosophy that you get people to behave properly is through this form of terrorism, in my opinion. That kind of punishment is nothing less than terrorism and torture,
mm-hmm,
against our own children.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that, I think, contributes greatly to children becoming angry and violent themselves. And so I think punishment is not the answer, that redemption is the answer. Incarceration in cases, yes. Separation, perhaps for the person's life. At least separation until society is convinced that this person is no longer a threat. But punishment is not the answer. And in Tukey Williams' case, that there was a clear case of redemption. I don't know if he was guilty or not, because to me the important criteria is not just guilt or innocence. We have to defend the Troy Davises, the innocent, and the Mumia Abu-Jamal. But we also have to defend the people who were driven to madness, to violence, like women who defended, who are on death row or who have life without parole sentences because they killed their abusive partners or husbands. I don't advocate, of course, that the women turn to that as a solution, but if we had the kinds of programs that could defend those women, provide them safe houses and all that, much greater numbers than we're doing, then we can't individually blame them, and that's what we tend to do. We sort out, we separate one person, say this person's guilty, we're going to punish that person, and as I said in the beginning, then we all think that we can move on, you know, and live in a safer world because we have all the bad guys either dead and buried or behind bars. And that's just not how we're going to solve these problems. It's liberty, it's equality, it's equal opportunity. It's reorienting our whole social structure so that every child born into this world is born into a world of love and solidarity and support. And that's how we will reduce the injustices, how we will reduce the violence in our world, not by killing more people. And it's interesting, I think, too, that this policy is also a similar policy in our foreign affairs, that we think that if a country or a people, you know, displease us, that if we bomb them, we can get the people of Iraq. If we have enough sanctions and kill 500,000 of their children, that the people of Iraq will come to their senses. instead of them moving in the opposite direction of more violence and anger and hatred, and in their opinion, you know, from their point of view, self-defense. Mm.
Daryl, I want to thank you for being with us. And yes, we've opened up a huge area of conversation, ongoing conversation, that Raising Sane does continue to bring to our listeners. Today it was great to have you with us and explaining the how you became involved in this and also talking about Troy. So I'm going to invite our listeners again to call the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles at 404-651-6671 or also call the board chair, Gail Buckner, at 404-657-9350.
All views expressed on Raising Sand are that of the hosts and guests, not of KZSU or Stanford University. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of Raising Sand on KZSU Stanford. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Now get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Now get up.
You see the light, hey. You stand up for.